Attention all you rule breakers, you misfits and troublemakers, all you free spirits and pioneers, all you visionaries and nonconformists.
Everything the establishment has told you is wrong with you is actually what's right with you. You see things others don't. You are hardwired to change the world.
You are listening to the Spiritual Activist Radio Show, and I am Rahasia Uncensored, where we look at the world not as it is, but as we know it can be, if and only if we have the courage to question the answers we've been given. This is our world, and it's time for us to take it back. So, Neil, I think I would like to take this conversation in a direction to where what is happening today. But first, I think we should get a little background from you.
Okay.
We've had a lot of interest in UFOs. Our last issue was this one. Are we alone? And I think more we know we're not alone. We've never been alone. But sometimes you have to talk to the people and wake them up. I think the more appropriate question is, who are we and where did they come from? Questions like this that we need to get to. But first, tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, I've always respected the way you come across. I get really, frustrated with people sometimes because the evidence is out there. I mean, when I'm trying to explain UFOs and extraterrestrials, I mean, don't you read? Don't you just have a brain, you know? And I get a little bit like this. And I've always respected the way you come across so smooth and so calm and level-headed. I think that is the correct approach to take with people. So tell us a little bit about yourself. And didn't you have an encounter in 1942?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, that's probably the reason why I can come across as kind of matter-of-factly as I do, as you say. I hadn't thought of it like that, but I can appreciate what you're saying. Yes, and I had two encounters as a kid. One was I was only 6 years old. I was picked up and tweaked, and I didn't know who they were, and I didn't see them. And then in 1942, I had another encounter, but that was in the middle of the night. I was woken up in a blue cloud field, and it was very definitely aliens. I was being held up by four little gray guys who were actually having fun. They were acted almost as if they were apprentices. And holding me up weightless, and they wanted me to have fun. They didn't want me to be fearful at all or whatever. And there was another sergeant, taller, well, bigger, gray at my head, and I had to look backwards at him. And he was guiding the conversation, and he wanted me to ask, you know, who are you? What are you? And when I telepathically thought that at him, he said, we're androids. And this was 1942, before, you know, 5 years before Roswell or any of that stuff right. started down. And so it turned out that it was a relatively short encounter. He said and then the next question was, well, you know, what do you want? And he said, well, we want to ask you. And this was, I mean, for a 12-year-old kid, he was being extremely respectful and wanted me to be cool and wanted it all to be pleasant. And he said, we want to ask you to help us get introduced into the planet. And at that point, there was some overtones of reintroduced, but that word was never used. It was introduced into the planet. And someplace along the line, the word Anaki or Anunnaki was used. And the next question was, and when I said yes to the request, because it was so novel, they were obviously aliens. It was so amazing, and they were being so respectful, and it seemed so honest that I said yes. And when I did, he immediately, through some subcortical channel, put this huge, what seemed like a huge ball of information into my head. And I thought, wow, I was an information junkie at that point already, at 12, 12 and a half. And I thought, wow, that's information, you know, wow. But I don't understand any of it. And he told me, he said, well, it's not meant for now. You won't understand it. Gradually you will. And it's meant for much, much later. Giving me to believe that it was like when I was going to be 70 or something. And that's actually the way it turned out. And so then the next question I was prompted into was, well, the formation of the question was, well, if you're androids, which he gave me to understand was a combination of humanoid and robot, and I think he used the word robot specifically because I didn't know what android meant, but I did know what robot meant because I was reading Flash Gordon in the funny papers. You remember him?
Oh yeah, I do.
Yeah, and so having gotten that taken care of, when I asked her, well, who's the management? You know, who's the boss? Who's running the show? Who's really doing the asking? This curtain was pulled aside symbolically. And there was this big heavyset dude in a white robe and a big Semitic beard with, you know, this type of Semitic beard. And obviously not God, or not meant to be a God figure of that sense, in the sense of cosmic at all. In fact, I could even catch his pleasant body scent. And I'm sure that he wanted me to do that so that I understood that it was definitely humanoid.
Right.
And he practically exuded gratitude for me saying yes. That was at the point someplace in there when I was curious as to who they were at the word that my mother asked me about later when I told my parents. She said, after 2 or 3 days of thinking about it, she said, what's an android?
Right.
And I said, obviously, you know, a combination of humanoid and robot. And she said, okay. And then she wanted to know, did they have a name? And I said, well, you know, there was a word that sounded like Anaki or something like that. But I, not having any reference points for it, I couldn't, you know, I was just recalling that. And obviously it was Anunnaki at that particular point. And so that was about the size of it. Until about 3 months afterwards, it was wintertime, and I went to bed, but this time I just put my head on a pillow about 9 o'clock at night. My mother and father were still having a cup of coffee and conversation in the kitchen and stuff, and the light coming through the pinholes in the dark green shade that kept the street light. This was Poughkeepsie, New York, second story residential type house. The light started to come through the pinholes really strongly. And I thought, what's that all about? So I looked outside and it looked as if the street light or a light outside was getting brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter. Ran into the kitchen, got my parents. They came. My father was a hard-nosed Poughkeepsie cop. He saw it, and he took the old top-hung wooden storm window off completely, took it inside the house, and the the two, he and I, ended up sitting on the windowsill outside, holding onto the window, looking up above the house where this light obviously was emanating from. And there was this bright cloud of light up there. And then we could see portholes. It was a ship. No sound, obviously, typically, no sound, portholes, and clearly a saucer-type ship. And he's looking at me and looking at the ship, and it's like, what have I got on my hands here?
Right. it's amazing they took it so well, because the only frame of reference that they really had was the War of the Worlds broadcast.
Yeah, yes. Well, he did tell me, then the ship, just after about maybe only a minute and a half, shot off into space like a typical no sound going into warp drive. And it was, in an instant. And he told me later on, he was pretty cool about it, because he went inside, he immediately got on the phone, called the police station and asked if anybody had seen anything, extraordinary.
Yeah.
And of course the word was no. And none of the neighbors ever said anything about it, but it was obvious up there. And so what they did is they came back to reassure the parents that the kid, at 12 years old was not going bonkers. Mm-hmm. And I think, he, if not both he and my mother, appreciated that, because they had talked to the priest about it, and they had no reference points. But my father did tell me, after maybe a year, that previous to my experience at 12, he was doing motorcycle duty in the middle of the night, 4 o'clock in the morning, up a main deserted drag. And this huge green silent thing came over the top of them. So
it seems to be a generational thing quite a bit.
Yes, yes, yes. And so, I think they did that purposely to prep him up for it.
So it must have been a really good sigh of relief when you ran across Zachariah Sitchin's work, huh?
Oh, well, yeah. Yes. I mean, when I look back, and even when I was going through a lot of stuff between 12 and in my 70s, I could see that the big heavy boss, humanoid, I might consider even that it was, somebody like Enki or whatever, but no name was ever given. So I don't know.
So I'm assuming from what you're saying that probably, it seems like when the Anunnakis used to come here, they had to wait till they got pretty close to the planet to take off with rocket ships. But I would imagine their technology now is allowing them to come back and forth from wherever, right?
I think we have to assume that, after a couple of thousand years, I think they were bordering on, if not in possession of efficient anti-grav technology 2,000 years ago. And now 2,000 years later, I have little doubt that they are the ones that show up in saucers frequently. I like to fly over in Mexico City back in the 90s, at the time of the eclipse.
Yeah, 1991.
Something like that, yeah.
So, Neil, something I've always wondered about? I mean, we're learning, even at our level of evolution and seeing how societies evolve and can be interacted with, we're learning real quick, like, that intervening prematurely into an evolutionary society, like indigenous peoples, is not a good thing to do. They end up living in brothels on drugs, and it completely collapses their civilization, their society, that was slowly evolving the way it should. And it seems to me that if we've learned this, that other advanced races have learned this many millions of years ago, which makes me wonder, it seems to me that the Anunnakis probably broke some galactic cosmic laws by coming here and prematurely intervening into our society, and on top of that, genetically altering us.
Well, not just genetically altering it, actually literally creating us by, you know, in a laboratory. I mean, you can say easily that the evolutionists, the Darwinian evolutionists and the creationists are both half right and half wrong.
Right.
There was a creation, but it was in a genetic laboratory, in a place in East Central Africa where the genetic search for Eve, which was done in the 90s, looking for the oldest DNA, mitochondrial DNA in women around the world. It's like you can put your finger on the map for both of those things, for the Anunnaki's genetic laboratory and the search for Eve's determination that was where the first woman came from.
Yeah, I think the path of mitochondria, you know, the genetic sequencing they've been doing using the female mitochondria, I think that even leads right to the same exact place, right about the same exact time.
Exact time, exact place, 200,000 years ago. And so, and not only was there a creation, but it was in a genetic laboratory, but we are evolving, but we're not evolving according to the usual rules, on natural processes of Darwinian evolution. You know, by comparison, it took Homo erectus a million years to go from rough flake stone tools to smooth ones. And we, in 200,000 years, have gone from square one, actually getting genetically engineered as a species, to going to Mars. Well, maybe we're up there already.
Yeah.
You know, if you can. But still, it just is a comparison that shows that we are not following the Darwinian
model. You know, I've talked to evolutionists. I wrote a book on belief systems, and part of doing the research, I was talking to evolutionists, biblical scholars, rabbis, just. What is it about us that makes us get so confirmed in our beliefs? And I recognize that evolutionists are just as much into a belief system, and by not accepting the fact that there's not only a missing link, but there might be an extraterrestrial reason for it, this is where the intelligent design people come in and attack evolution, saying, aha, it had to be God.
Sure.
And it's a matter of definition with God. And if we would open up, like, every critic I've ever heard speaking against this has never looked at the information. You know, it like blows my mind, you know, because you start talking with them. Like, I've had people attack me over my book because of some of the things I say about the Bible, which are really sort of straightforward, upfront, you know, not derogatory, just factual information. And come to find out, they've never really read the Bible. You know, they have
right. They
have little quick little sayings that they've memorized over the years. And, you know, in a 10-minute conversation, it sounds like, oh, they must know the Bible. But you go into it a half hour, 45 minutes, and you start realizing that they've never read the information, let alone taking it back to where a biblical scholar would start saying, okay, where did the Torah come from? Where did this information come from? They've never done this.
Yeah, sure, because... you know, honest scholars of today, if they're paying attention and open-minded at all, know that the Book of Genesis and the Old Testament, but the Book of Genesis especially, is simply a 3,000-year younger rewrite of the original Sumerian documentation in history. And it's not only is it a rewrite, but it's a very skewed rewrite. And that's why I've appreciated not only Zechariah Sitchin's work, because of the meticulous scholarship and his ability to translate and read, you know, a clay tablet like you know, I can read the newspaper, but also the work of Sir Lawrence Gardner.
Oh, yeah.
Both of whom are deceased at this particular point, unfortunately. I have very, very uncomfortable feelings around the death of Sir Lawrence Gardner. Zechariah, okay, so he was 90. Doesn't mean that he was supposed to die, but and the Egyptians, of course, try to kill him. You know that story with dropping his debris on his head and nearly splitting his skull.
Yeah, we definitely need more secular researchers in this field, because just getting caught up in the Judeo-Muslim Christian idea that the earth is 6,000 years old really puts some tough parameters on your research.
God, yes.
Yeah, I interviewed John Anthony West here a while back. He's the guy that discovered with Robert Schoch that the Sphinx was much older than 4,000 BC. As a matter of fact, it either goes back to one of the processions, which he could make it as old as 30 or 36,000 years old.
Sure.
And all we need to do is ask the right questions with an open mind, and it leads you to some pretty logical answers eventually.
Oh, yeah. I know John. I've spoken at conferences with him. And
yeah, he's pretty cool.
I haven't seen him in a while, but...
Yeah, our interview turned into more of a conversation because we're both George Gurdjieff followers, and Gurdjieff came up because Gurdjieff was right along the lines of maybe Schwaller, and Schwaller was sort of the preeminent guy that discovered some of the sacred geometry behind the temples. In other words, the temples weren't just a place where teachings took place; they were a place. They were the teachings, you know? So we got going on Gurdjieff, and it just turned into an amazing little conversation. Yeah, he's quite a person.
Yeah, I have his book on the shelf. I know him personally. And Schwaller de Lubitz he was off to the side a little bit on the transcendental type of approach, and I think that we could. I'd like to take the history first, the science and history first, and then take the speculative, transcendental stuff, and then maybe contactees after the fact, and then channelers last.
Right.
Okay, so where were we here? there's so much to cover. You know, I keep going off in tangents, and I apologize.
That's okay. Tangents is a good thing right now, because actually the society, the civilization we live in is, have you ever noticed that it doesn't matter what conspiracy trail you follow, governments, military law, the financial system, the Illuminati, UFOs, aliens, it all makes sense to a certain point, and then all of a sudden it makes no sense at all. So that tells me we're missing a big piece of the puzzle. And what do you think that might be? You think it's a scientific piece, or you think it's something to do with extraterrestrials, or what is it that would unify all of these things that are happening? Everything's collapsing right now. Governments, they're broken, dangerous. We're out there all over the planet right now creating havoc. There's a big financial thing going on right now with Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, and China putting together a whole nother monetary system that hardly anybody knows about up here.
Right.
There's all this, and if any one of these was true, it would be really something to be concerned with. But there's 10 or 15 of these things, and they're all, if you plot them out on a graph, on a linear time graph, they all seem to be meeting in our immediate future, like this year almost.
Mm-hmm.
So something's happening.
I think The best way I can answer that is to come at it from the perspective of the piece that C.B. Scott Jones and I in our Cosmic Humanity think tank wrote. I think I sent you a copy of that one.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, we're pushing for disclosure, but the Declaration of Cosmic Humanity simply said, we demand, as a people, speaking for ourselves and for the rest of the people on the planet, generally, we know that we are being offered participation in cosmic society, but we've also been given the rules. You know, you don't take weapons into space, kids. And secondly, you matriculate into stellar society as a species, not as a tribe, not as a nation, not even as a culture or a civilization. You matriculate as a unified, peaceful species. And the major things that are keeping us from doing that are the constant wars that we're at, which are provoked primarily on political ideologies, but also on the basis of the God-fearing religions that we have developed over time.
Right.
And so. What we're saying is that if we're going to disclose, we have to disclose fully. And to disclose fully, we have to first acknowledge the presence of alien societies, plural, here. Recognize that there is a potential for us to become part of those societies, and how we have to do it as a unified, peaceful species. The second thing we have to disclose, and this directly speaks to what your question or your comment was about having to know who we are and what we're about and where we fit into the cosmic picture. And that requires full disclosure of our genetically engineered creation as a slave species, our subsequent development as partners, partial partners, at least with the Anunnaki, and our current situation as a species that is coming out of racial adolescence. In order to do that, we need to recognize that the quote-unquote God-fearing religions, not Buddhism and Taoism, and Confucianism so much, they're more lifestyles geared to expanded consciousness and evolving consciousness. Whereas the God-fearing religions are, you know, you'll go to heaven or hell depending on how you act, and here's the rules, and don't you forget it. And so we can see that there are two main traditions that we emulate, depending on how we choose. We know, and I think that Sir Lawrence Gardner's research and conclusions are totally valid. He says, when you go back and you read these things in the context of the Old Testament being a rewrite of the original Hebrew and so on, and of the 3,000 year older Sumerian documents, then you can see quite clearly that Enki, the one brother of the two brothers that basically ran the planet, colony on the planet here, the Anunnaki.
And he was the one that was sort of for
humans. The Lord. And Lil, his brother, was Jehovah Yahweh.
Right.
And knowing very well that there was more than one of them, the Levite priest, in order to curry the favor more of Enlil, melded those two characters together in a singular, in a plural word used as a singular, Elohim.
Right. Right.
And so, of course, one of the reasons for the suppression and cover-ups is that certainly the Vatican or radical Hebrew priests and religious, and or the Muslim, you know, brotherhood or whomever, don't want this out
right.
because it's curtains. And so we have to recognize that we are coming out of racial adolescence, and we the Anunnaki certainly would help. And I think, as you pointed out, that they may have had a problem by the fact that they did a genetic creation of a human species and treated us the way they did. And I think that they have, this is speculation at this point, but I think that they have tried to rectify that and meet the conditions for being in stellar society. So anyway, the third condition that we're demanding in the Declaration of Cosmic Humanity is acknowledgement, recognition, and scientific documentation of the 10th planet, the Anunnaki home planet, Nibiru, because it not only is it significant as their home planet and as a planet in our solar system, but it also is a threat to us sometimes. Every 3,600 years when it comes through, if the conditions are right and the planets are all in such an alignment that it comes close to Earth and influences us, it can raise holy hell, quite frankly. If you read a book like A Cataclysm by Alan and Dallaire, the two British scientists, one is a cartographer, but the other one is a geophysicist, you can see that around 9,500 or 10,000 BC, we had one of those passages. And that's documented as the flood in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and even people like Velikovsky, that the scientist, they really ridiculed his writings.
So,
you know, but it's making more and more sense as we go along for planet formation.
Sure.
What he was saying, you know.
Yeah, I think that he was very close, but I think that the records that were and what was taught to us about the formation of the solar system, contained, the neat thing was that we have found over the last 150 years, not only scattered records, but we have found completely intact libraries in Iraq and archaeologically discovered, complete libraries in sealed rooms. The clay tablets, lined up and cataloged on shelves.
Right.
So we have a complete history of the formation of our solar system, of our genetic creation, of the incident in 10,000 BC of Nibiru coming through the solar system. And Alan and Dallaire say that by their best estimation, no more than 1,000 plus maybe humans survived on the entire planet here.
That would really make a dramatic effect on our collective consciousness too.
That too.
You know, that would really put us in a frame of mind to really take these cataclysmic happenings very, very serious and with a lot of collective fear over these things.
Mm-hmm. And people say, when is it coming back the next time? And Sitchin did the mathematics, chronological mathematics, and he said, to the best of his knowledge, 2058. So, and then when he did that amazing the conference, I guess you could call it, or interview with Harrington of the Naval Observatory, who invited him in after reading his book and saying, Yes. you know more from the ancient records than we do, but I already know. I remember Harrington blew me away when I first saw that video. He said, I'm sure enough, sure, quite sure from the records that we already have, from the Pioneer spacecraft, from the studies we've done computer-wise, and the residuals, the wobbles in the planet orbits and so on, that it is not only there, but it is probably Uranus-sized at least. And it also, he said, I'm quite confident, has an atmosphere that we would be comfortable in. And I thought to myself, how the bloody hell did he know that much detail? You know,
yeah, that's a lot of detail.
And it was not only, it was just a little while ago that after that interview with Sitchin in the early 90s, that he sent a team with a scope to Blackbirch, New Zealand. He already knew, as the ancient records say, that its orbit is tipped to the plane, the flat plane of the ecliptic, by about 40 degrees. So it comes up somewhat from our relative south. And so we wouldn't be able to see it until it crossed the ecliptic. And so he knew that you'd have to go down the southern hemisphere. Right. And that's probably why they put the new astronomical observatory right at the South Pole.
Yeah, and the Vatican has something down there too, because even in biblical writings, they write about wormwood and all these cultures, Nemesis. We've always had names for this, but I think they're talking about the same planet.
Oh, I'm sure.
And we have a lot going on right now at the Antarctic. For some reason, we're deeply concerned what's coming in from the south of our planet.
Really? And we should be. We should be. You know, when a Uranus-sized planet comes into the right proximity of Earth, we don't stand a chance.
Yeah, and it's going to be dragging a lot of asteroids out of the belt area, too. So there's going to be a lot of activity there. Yeah, apparently Kennedy was going to reveal, if he could come across the information, he was going to reveal it too, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And we know what happened to him.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
These are pretty powerful people. And I was talking to he's a pioneering microbiologist. And he said, it looks like right now, with the evidence that we have, that about 6% of the population lacks the ability to have compassion and empathy. And when you lack compassion and empathy, it gives you a little bit of an advantage if you're striving to be a politician or a corporate CEO, because they do things. I think to myself, now, how in this world could they do that knowing the repercussions of their actions? Well, they can do it because they have no feelings in regard to compassion and empathy. And I think that that's what's happened. We've let these people rise to the top. And in a sick kind of a way, it's like we admire them, the Milkins and the people that just rob people blind. We write books about them and make movies about them. And we need a new collective consciousness. I like what Einstein said. We're never going to come up with solutions from the same level that created the problems.
No.
And I think spiritually and consciously, it almost feels like we have to do our part, Neil. Like, get over our fears, for one, but really start opening up our hearts to one another. And if we can do that enough, maybe there will be a 100th monkey kind of a reaction globally. But it seems like we have to grow up. We have to do our part in being a mature civilization before they can either legally or morally intervene and interact with us.
Right. And I think, which brings up the interesting point of alien agendas and attitudes. I think you know, maybe the sci-fi writers knew more than we did at that point. And they said, you know, there's a prime directive. You don't interfere with another species and, you know, so on. And I think that it seems quite apparent that that is the attitude. And we've been told, apparently, by alien species that that is their approach. But on the other hand, there are some limitations, points at which they will intervene. And you talk to a fellow like Bob Sala, you know, who was a lieutenant colonel and was sitting at the console of underground bunker where they had 15 missiles in silos with nuclear warhead tips on them. I was having breakfast with him when we both spoke at the Exopolitics Kona conference. And I said, Bob, what was it like? He said, well, I'm sitting there with my face hanging out and the lights are going out. They're turning the saucers. One came over and then another, apparently, and turned all the missiles off. I said, did they turn them back on, Bob? And he said, no. No, they didn't. The message was quite clear. Stop playing with those things, kids, before you blow yourselves up. And we're not going to allow you to do this because it's affecting the whole surrounding solar system, at least.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. We don't really know what happens when we do let off an atomic bomb in the third dimension. It's a big explosion, but interdimensionally, it might be causing dangerous rips through the fabric of one dimension to another that we don't even have a clue about.
Oh, I'm sure we don't have a damn clue at all. you know, you kids stop playing with the way he put it was very succinct.
Right.
We have that evidence. And then I think that we need to explore more. And I've been pushing in the Exopolitics conference for this. But we need to differentiate more between all the different species that we have known about, heard about, read about, encountered, have gotten information from, and those are pretty obviously from outside our solar system. But we also have the unique situation of our relationship to the Anunnaki, which we really need to resolve.
Right.
It's like the 21-year-old going back to the parents' house and saying, you know, let's talk. Let's resolve some of these things, that have gone down between us. And so, we've got a lot on our plate. We've got a lot to do. And so, where do we go from here? Well, I think that, Scott and I, and as a think tank, have been pushing, the agendas we have. You certainly are doing great stuff. And there's more and more people who are doing radio interviews and so on. And that's only part of it. I see that there are academics who are now beginning to, kind of feel their way into the field. And I'm sure that they're sweating it because of peer pressure or tenure tetanus,
right.
Funding fright, all those things. I would not want to be in the academic world and trying to do these things, myself now. So this year, I think good things. I think positive things as a beginning. It's going to take a while for the academic world to come around. It's going to take a while for the politicians to disclose. And your take on the psychology of the politicians, I think, is very right on.
What we're heading for right now is a more informed society that will stop voting these people in.
Mm-hmm.
It has to get down to that, because without an informed society, we're destined just to keep voting these morons in, and that's obviously not working.
No, it's not working for us. It may be working for their pocket change, but it's not working for us.
Yeah, and the odd thing is, it's working for them on a financial level, but even the financial level, that's a matter of opinion. It's every fiat system that's ever existed on this planet throughout history has always collapsed.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder, are these people really that stupid, or are they just diabolically so deceptive that they're doing something that we can't quite figure out. And the only thing I can figure out is they're out after global control. And I think at this point, they're really out after depopulating the Earth, like Agenda 21. The United Nations talks clearly about this, that for this planet to survive, we need to get down to a half a billion people, which means that 13 out of 14 people need to find another place to live.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there are some active agendas, and it could be that the Nibiru thing is one of them. Maybe they're thinking the same thing that they thought back in the flood. Well, we just let this happen and come back and we'll see what happens after the flood, you know?
Well, which flips me back to the point I was making about Enki being Adonai the Lord and Enlil being Jehovah Yahweh. Enki being a scientist who invented us genetically was much more inclined to be empathic and sympathetic and benevolent towards humans, whereas Enlil, his brother, was he was nasty, right. You know, and male dominant and so on. And so if we look backwards at the development of Western culture particularly, we can see that those who instinctively or genetically or whatever, humans coming along, took up Enlil's attitude and emulated his approach, ended up to be the male chauvinist, dominant, dictatorial, and oppressive rulers. And you could say that about the bishops of the early church, who were all Jewish, coming from the Hebrew interpretation of the old scriptures and emulating Enlil. Whereas those who were in the bloodline, and that's a whole another fascinating topic. As Sir Lawrence Gardner has put it out, to go back and recapitulate that history a little bit first, he says that when you read the Old Testament, particularly Genesis in the original Hebrew, it does not say, as the classic interpretation of it currently has always been, that Cain was a bad guy who actually killed his brother. He says, you read it in the Old Testament, in the ancient original Hebrew, it says Cain was superior to Abel. Didn't say anything about killing him. He was superior. And he said, when you investigate that scene thoroughly, you realize that Enki, knowing that they, as a species, were going to sort of vacate the planet or at least move back and let humans take over, and some of them did go back to Nibiru, he selected a human female. This is the second Adam and Eve story in Genesis. And he selected a human female, fathered a child by her. The child's name was Cain, from which comes Cain, kinship, kingship. And he invented this line by putting his extra genetics, you know, advanced Anunnaki genetics in the line, so that these, the males that were procreated in that line would be of advanced mentality and learning and so on. And they were to be at first foremen and learn the ropes. And then when the Anunnaki phased off, they were to take over as kings. And they were trained, he says, very clearly as quote unquote, servants of the species, servants of the people. And that's the way they were to act benevolently and for the best interests of the people. Whereas Enlil's emulators, you know, they were male dominant and often very cruel. Out of which came the first bishops of the church and the Roman Catholic Empire. And so I think that Lawrence Gardner has done us a big, big favor by bringing all this out. He was enlisted by 30 royal families in Europe as a genealogist to...
Yeah, the genealogy in the back of his books, that just blew my mind, that how he broke everything down, the bloodlines.
The whole thing, right yeah. there. Well, he had a unique access to their private archives. And he told me, he said, you know, at first I got into this and I kept asking them, what is this special line of kings that's referred to all the time? And they would say, well, did you find our great, 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 great grandfather or something? He said, no, come on, level with me. Finally, they said, that's the Grail. You know, Graal, special bloodline in Sumerian, come up through Sangreal and you know, Holy Grail.
Yeah, it's an amazing body of work.
Oh God.
Yeah. I have all of his books, and every time I look through it, I just go, like, I mean, it looks like lifetimes of work. I don't even know how he did it.
I know.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
An impressive mind, let me tell you.
And, you know, and it seems like, Neil, that whole mindset was, they were at the perfect time of our procession. When we're sort of into more of an unconsciousness during the Middle Ages and all that.
Yes.
But now, now as we're coming out of that, we're starting to collectively wake up. And I think we're seeing all of these patriarch organizations and governments and political agendas that are wrapped up in with what you're saying. They're starting to lose their foundations and losing their support.
Losing control.
Yep.
And they know it. They know that if it gets to a tipping point, it's all over. And that's why at the end of Sapiens Rising, you know, I put in the chapter about futons, you know, those are 1 to 2.5% of the population at any given time that are the evolutionary scouts, futons right. that experience the future and come back. Like the bees, the honey bees do, and do a little dance for everybody else and to point out the direction that they think, you know, evolution should go in. And also the suggestion for a computerized new type of government, awake and not taking any lunch breaks, you know, 24/7, able to learn and take us beyond government, which is based on representation by strangers.
Right.
I think it's inevitable. But it's going to be slow. But we need to start deliberately calling on the young to get involved and, you know, to contribute.
Well, Neil, we'll have to do this again sometime.
Oh, great.
You know, I really, really enjoyed this, and I really appreciate your time, too. Is there anything you'd like to close with?
My pleasure. And what I would suggest, and we do this broadcast, and you publicize it as you usually do, mm-hmm. and then maybe gather together comments and questions from your audience that we can address the next time.
Okay.
Because you know, it's almost inevitable. The topic is so broad
right.
that we're all over the lot, and yep. and obviously probably half of it or a third of it. Somebody out there hasn't heard about it before, and they'll have questions. It'd be good if you did that.
Absolutely, yeah. I did this with Drunvalo. Do you know him? Drunvalo.
Oh, Drunvalo Melchizedek.
Yeah, I did this with his, and I put the word out to the community, and I was bombarded by emails with questions. So I'll do that with you, and maybe we can line up another interview in a month or so.
Sure, anytime.
All right, Neil.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
You have a great day.
Take care.